Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Alexander Hamon. He has been living in the United States since 1992, when he was awarded a visit to America, and then war broke out in his native Sarajevo. He's stayed basically ever since, learning to speak English, to write in English, and now he's published his first book. It's a combination of autobiography and autobiographical essays, much as some of his earlier work, particularly Nowhere Man, has been a mixture of novel and short stories. That fractional form, why is it attractive to you?
Well, I guess I experience the world as a bunch of fragments that have to be organized in some cogent manner. At least I should try to organize it. All the fractures can never be smoothed out fully, and in fact, I believe that's where meaning comes from. The meaning arises, between two shots, and so I'm have an instinctive resistance to smooth narratives.
There's a fascinating moment in the book, The Book of My Lives. It's published by Farrar, Straus and Giroux. You talk about a teacher of yours who taught you close reading, who forces you to see the work of literature outside of its political context with nothing but linguistic meaning. It used to be called the New Criticism. And lo and behold, he turns out to be one of the tyrants in the revolution. He is a torturer. He's a killer. He's aiding and abetting. And you say that now you discover that literature, however pleasurable it is to consider as an artifact of language, now it must have a political basis.
Well, it ends up having a political basis, even if, as I did when I was young. If you think of it as a haven away from the filth of politics and history, that forces you to step away from things that need to be confronted. Essentially, while I was busying myself with reading closely works of literature, he was organizing genocide with his friends in Serbian leadership. He was an ideologue rather than someone had, his hands on immediate military and police operations in the war in Bosnia. But whatever literature and art he had been exposed to stopped him in no way from doing what he was doing. And to me, that was the great lesson of that time of my life. I had believed in the noble value of literature, of art by extension. I believe that if you expose yourself to Shakespeare or Beethoven or Raymond Chandler, it turns you into a better person. But it doesn't work that way. So the war has proven to me, and I've spoken to a lot of friends of mine, that someone who hasn't really read a book can have a moral instinct that is superior to the moral instinct of my ex-professor.
How is a moral instinct educated? Is it just what necessity?
I don't think that everyone who has ever thought, including myself, that a literature is ennobling, that it turns into a better person, is crazy. Because there is a moral aspect to literature in that there are readers, at least some of them, and writers, who engage with literature. By engaging in literature, they engage with the world. It's a way for them to connect and be in the world with other people. But that's not the only way it works. And the agency that is available in literature for people of that sensibility is also available outside of it in various ways. In some ways, that's what democracy is. It's a way for us to connect with other people from our individual positions, as it were, to collaborate and cooperate in building a society, to feel responsible, to other people in various ways in practice that responsibility. Literature, in other words, is a democratic operation that includes fascists too, much like a modern democracy might have to provide space for fascists. And of course, they need to be fought at every step, but they end up there, just like other people do.
Now, you never thought you'd be writing nonfiction. How did that begin?
It's not that I never thought. I've been writing nonfiction all along. It is that this is the first collection of nonfiction. And I've been writing nonfiction not only in English, as these pieces have been published over more than 10 years, but also I wrote in Bosnian, and I've worked as a journalist. And for many years, between 1996 and 2010, I wrote a column in Bosnian for a magazine in Sarajevo from Chicago. I mean, I would email it from Chicago. And those columns were nonfiction. I did not make up stories. And they ranged from, you know, political rants about the Bush regime to stories from the diaspora, the Bosnian diaspora.
And there is nonfiction in the novels as well. You do historical research in the Lazarus Project. Is there a difference in genres, or is that difference significant?
Well, in Bosnian and related Slavic languages like Croatian and Serbian, there is no word for nonfiction or for fiction, for that matter. My translator is working in Bosnia, is working on this book, on translating this book, and she has a hard time finding the word for nonfiction. This is not to say there is no distinction between truth and untruth, or, you know, imagination and reality, but rather that in terms of literary production, the distinction between fiction and nonfiction simply doesn't exist. The closest term that I would use to describe my book would be true stories. And I know this because the way I had to think about it is hard, because I knew this would be a question I would be asked. I realized in thinking about all that it tells true stories as I tell imagined stories or imaginative stories. That is, the storytelling need comes from the same place. The limitations on true stories are different. And also, they're not just stories. There's an essayistic part to it, but I've written essayistic parts, and except I've given them to characters in my fiction. The limitation is a different kind of responsibility toward the reader on the one hand, also to people who are part of those true stories. True stories and old stories by extension, but true stories are always necessarily shared. That is, if I write about my family, then I have a responsibility to represent their lives responsibly so that I don't lie about them. And for that reason, I checked things with my family. I asked my sister, is this what happened? Or my friend, who's practically my family, you know, is this what happened with the dog? I checked facts with them. And then as they were published, many of the pieces were published in The New Yorker. The New Yorker has a, you know, very famous fact-checking department. They check many of those facts. Because the responsibility of the reader is that this will be not made up.
There's an extraordinary final essay. It's called The Aquarium, and it's about the death of your daughter who died in her first year. And it alters the book because many of the preceding essays have had humor to fall back upon. But in that essay, the obligation to painful fact is part of the truth-telling mechanism. And it seems to take the book and put it on a whole different level, because we're told again and again that you were not in Sarajevo during the war, that the reports came to you from friends and on television, and here is a nightmare in your own life, and there's no escape into humor. What is the style that is the style of painful fact?
I don't know if there's a style, but I needed to confront that as it was happening, my wife and I and my older daughter, we needed to confront this. It was not an intellectual project. It was a survival project, so the survival of my daughter. It required a different kind of lucidity. For one thing, language needed to be not more precise, but rather the flourishes that I'm prone to, sometimes unfortunately, sometimes proudly, would not apply in a situation like that. It required, it's a kind of responsibility that I mentioned, but, you know, of a different mode, in that, that in, for the sake of the truthfulness of her experience and our experience as a family, I had to find a way to talk about this without failing to be truthful. My wife, before I even decided to write it, I talked to her about the whole thing, whether I should write it and how she would feel about that. But then after I wrote it, she read it. And, you know, that's the ultimate fact-checking. That's our experience. It's not just my experience. It's we are the parents of Isabel. She had to fact-check it in a very emotional way.
There's a extraordinary, I think, and terrifying moment when you comment that people begin to say to you, well, language fails.
Words fail, yeah.
Words fail under these circumstances. And your answer is, no, unfortunately, words don't fail. Platitudes fail.
Right.
Commonplaces fail. Usual forms of sympathy fail. But words, the specificity of what is happening, that never stops.
We must seek the words that can extend into new experiences to us individually, but to new experiences for a whole community of readers or a nation or a city. So that if you have not experienced war, you don't have words for that. But then if there's war, this is what people in Sarajevo did, you find words for that. That's what literature is about. So to concede defeat before you even try is responsible for a writer in more ways than one. And again, it's a different kind of responsibility. In a situation which, you know, my daughter is dying, that if I'm going to write about this, those words have to have weight. They should not be wasted. They should be precise and they should be responsible.
I'm talking to Alexander Hamon, and we're talking about the extraordinary essay called The Aquarium, which is the concluding section of his volume, The Book of My Lives. Now, in that essay, there's a moment that really wowed me, in which your older daughter, Ella, in trying to deal with the illness of her sister, she speaks to her doll. It's an alien doll whose name, you name it, Mingus. And she starts to tell stories, impossible stories that might have been called by a less sensitive parent lies or inventions. Instead, you feel it's the explosion of language when it tries to deal with things that it has no way of dealing with. Tell me about that.
Ella was 2.5 2.75 when Isabel got sick. And this is also the time, the age when the language instinct, the language machinery in her brain kicked in. So all these words that she has absorbed and encountered were available to her, but she didn't have experience to apply the words to. So for instance, she knew the words California or Seattle, but she had never been in California or Seattle, nor could she conceptualize those places. So she would deploy Mingus to go to California and Seattle and come up with these, flowing stories about Mingus doing this and that. But it also coincided, as I said, with Isabel's illness. So because we never hid it from her what was happening and talked to her about the fact that Isabel had the tumor and that she was in hospital and she had to undergo treatment, Ella deployed Mingus to deal with that too. So Mingus would have a tumor and Mingus would undergo treatment. And she was processing that experience by talking about Mingus. Mingus was at that time a blue inflatable doll, but at some point Mingus deflated and became purely imaginary. And she, to this day, uses Mingus to talk about and understand what is going on in her life. At this time, she has a different level of consciousness. I asked her recently, how is it that I never met Mingus? You always talk about him. You know, why can't I meet Mingus? I would like to talk to him. And she laughed at me and said, Tata, she calls me Tata. It's Bosnian for dad. She says, Tata, Mingus is imaginary. And it just confirmed to me what I had thought about in relation to her experience with Isabel's illness. Is that for her, there's no contradiction between real and imaginary. That is, to understand the real, you have to deploy the imaginary. There's no other way around it. You cannot just know reality without deploying imagination. And that's what she was doing, and that's what literature does. This is what the project that I have been involved in for so many years.
Did you feel that living in those circumstances helped to erase those borders?
Well, I mean, you know, authoritarian regimes, ideological regimes, and this includes the United States too, fully depend on consensual delusions and imaginary projects. The war in Iraq, invasion of Iraq, the majority of the nation decided to believe in the weapons of mass destruction because it was easier that way, I suppose. And then there we went to war. To think that reality is something that we can simply recognize instantly is a little lazy. The upside of that is that it makes fiction necessary. When the Bush regime people started constructing political realities out of imaginary facts, if such things exist, I was able to recognize it instantly, not because I'm smart, but because I was good at the business of constructing fiction. And I had been exposed to ideological constructions on the part of the state and government.
I'm very interested. Intellectuals, American intellectuals, used to say that Americans did not treasure its writers, its fiction, its written traditions, because we've had extraordinary freedom of the press and that we were not under the persecution that writers whose every word jeopardized the writer's life. We've slid into very different circumstances now, and yet still there's been no sign that our writers are more treasured. And yet it seems to me at the same time, you've come, you received a Genius Award, there have been many recognitions. Do you feel that these are recognitions for your suffering, or are they literary awards? What has happened to literature?
Well, I hope they're not for my suffering. For one thing, there are people who have suffered far more from Bosnia, where I come from. Or, you know, there's always someone who suffers more than you. People I love have suffered, and I have not. You know, my suffering was related to my love for them. I don't know what happened to literature, and it's not for me to, you know, lecture other writers what they should do. Literature is a collective project, as it were, a spontaneous collective project, a network of sensibilities in which everyone can have a place. There is, however, a failure, I think, in addressing what happened, for instance, during, you know, after 9/11. I long for a novel that would actually address, and for aesthetical reasons, not political reasons, the ways in which that such a humongous lie was constructed in front of all of us, and we fell for it willingly and deliberately. This was not a well-constructed lie. It was evident that it was a lie, but we liked it. Why do we like it? To me, that's interesting, as I am someone who works in the business of fiction, in the business of constructing narratives. There is no great post-9/11 novel, none whatsoever, as of now. There are many great novels, and not everyone has to write such novels, but there's a lack.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Alexander Hemon about his book, The Book of My Lives. We'll continue after this short break.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Alexander Hemon about his new book, The Book of My Lives, a collection of memoiristic essays that, whether funny are heartbreaking, are most of all moving. You know, when the war in Vietnam was raging, it was also very common to say that we didn't have the novel of the war in Vietnam, that it hadn't been written. It took around 15 years before writers could address it in a novel. There were nonfiction reports, but even they took a long time to be published. I'm curious, in Sarajevo, Is there a novel about the war? How long does it take for consciousness to penetrate?
There are works that were written under siege, or at the time of the siege, that were the best books about war that I've read, among the best books, and certainly the best about the war in Bosnia. And then at this time, 20 years later, 21 years after the start of the war, there's a bit of an obsession with the war, so people have a hard time getting beyond that because it weighs so heavily. A friend of mine, Semezin Mehmedinovic, who lives in D.C., he wrote an extraordinary book called Sarajevo Blues, which includes poetry and short vignettes and essays that were published as during the siege in newspapers and magazines that were managed to be published under siege. And that, on the one hand, is performed books like that, particularly that one, Sarajevo Blues, and there's also another one by Milan Kojergovic, Sarajevo Marlboro. They perform the duty of bearing witness, but also they're extraordinary works of art.
It really is very meaningful to me that in this book, the book of my lives, there's another life at the end of the book. It's the personal life. And it's a decision, of course, to make the death of your daughter into a subject of public concern. Where do the personal and the private intersect?
Well, in another word that has no equivalent in Bosnian is privacy. There's no word for privacy in Bosnian, so that you in many ways live your life publicly. It's not a public of the American magnitude. That is, I'm not talking about, you know, celebrity news or reality TV shows, but rather within a community in which people live connected to each other daily. You would always open yourself to other people to various degrees, sometimes painfully, sometimes involuntarily. But this is what I long for in the end, and what I had in Sarajevo, at least I remember as having when I was younger, a community of people with whom I could speak and they would listen to me. And in return, obviously, I would listen to them. The enlarged equivalent of that is literature. This is what we do as readers and writers. This is what storytelling is. And it is not an accident that, you know, Bosnians and Sarajevans are very good at storytelling, because part of this communal collective bonding and my need for storytelling comes from that place. It's a way to connect with people and connect with the world. It is a way to confront difficult questions of human existence which are shared with other people. I don't have my own questions about human life. We share them to some extent. And I can assume as a writer and as a person that there are other people who might have similar interests. So one starts speaking to the void, as it were, but then the voices come back. And that's storytelling.
One of the reasons I was grateful for the final essay is that it moved me so much. At first, a kind of shock, and then a kind of resistance. No, please don't tell me. I don't want to know what happens in the emergency room. And then a realization that, yes, I have to know. And then the feeling, yes, that only this very precise language, however demonic, as you say, the names of the medications may sound, that this is the only language in which this can be told, that the writer is the person who, in refusing cliché or empty consolation, creates work of value. And so I wanted to see if you would read the final section of the essay Aquarium.
Sure. One of the most despicable religious fallacies is that suffering is ennobling, that it is a step on the path to some kind of enlightenment or salvation. Isabel's suffering and death did nothing for her or us or the world. The only result of her suffering that matters is her death. We learned no lessons worth learning. We acquired no experience that could benefit anybody. And Isabel most certainly did not earn ascension to a better place, as there has never been a place better for her than Terry's breasts, Ella's side, or my chest. Without Isabel, Terry and I were left with oceans of love we could no longer practice. We found ourselves with an excess of time we used to devote to her. We had to live inside a void that could be filled only by Isabel's presence. Isabel's indelible absence is now an organ in our bodies, whose sole function is a continuous secretion of sorrow. Ella talks about Isabel often. When she talks about her death, she does so cogently, her words deeply felt. She knows what happened and what it all means. She is confronted by the same question and longings as we are. Once, before falling asleep, she asked me, "Why did Isabel die?" Another time she told me, "I don't want to die." Not so long ago, she started talking to Terry out of the blue about wanting to hold Isabel's hand again, about how much she missed Isabel's laughter. A few times when we asked her if she missed Isabel, she refused to respond, exhibiting the kind of impatience that is entirely recognizable to us. What was there to talk about that was not self-evident? Mingus is still good and well, going steadily about his alternative existence business. Although he stays with us a lot, he lives around the corner yet again with his parents and variable number of siblings, most recently two brothers, Jacon and Cliff, and a sister, Piccadilly. He has had his own children, three sons at one point, one of whom was called Andy. When we went skiing, Mingus preferred snowboarding. When we went to London for Christmas, Mingus went to Nebraska. He plays chess, or chest in Ella's parlance, pretty well, it seems. Sometimes he yells at Ella, "Shut up, Mingus," she yells back. Other times he loses his own voice, but then speaks in Isabel's. He's also a good magician. With his magic wand, Ella says, he can make Isabel reappear.
Alexander Hamon, reading the conclusion of his essay, The Aquarium, which is also the final essay in the Book of My Lives. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Alexander Hamon, author most recently of the Book of My Lives, published by Farrar, Straus & Giroux. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from the Book of My Lives at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Let us know what you think of this show by making a comment at kcrw.com/bookworm. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Robert Dewhurst. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm. He is a bookworm. She is a bookworm. We are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Pora López-Colomé and Forrest Gander are our guests.
I am a bookworm. We are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air, new music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.